Welcome to number 8 in our continuing study in the book of Hebrews. You remember now what he's proven so far? He proved to us that Messiah, the Son, was superior to prophets, remember? Because Revelation until that time always came in little bits and pieces, and now it's complete in the person of the Son. He's proven to us that Messiah, the Son, is superior to angels, because angels are changeable, they're malleable, they're created, but Christ the Son reigns forever. Angels are servants, the Son is sovereign. Then he showed us that Christ was superior to Moses. The Son is over the house, Moses is a servant in the house. He showed us that Christ is superior to Joshua. Joshua could not give the people rest. Christ will give the people rest. And now the final phase of his argument is Christ is going to be better than any of these and all of these priests who descended from Aaron. And as he does that now, he begins to prove this from this little historical event that took place. To do that, he must show that Melchizedek as a person was superior to Abraham as a person. And because of the superiority Melchizedek in history had to Abraham in history, then Melchizedek is going to be superior to Levi, who came from Abraham, and he's going to be superior to Aaron, who came from Levi, who came from Abraham. So he proves this superiority on down from Melchizedek on. And since Messiah, Christ, priesthood, is after the order of Melchizedek, then Christ and his priesthood will be superior to any of the priesthood which has descended from Aaron and from Levi. So that's going to be his topic now, and that's the last thing he has to prove. And as he does that, this is going to be the proof, finally at last, of his proposition in Hebrews that the blood of Christ is superior to the blood of Old Testament animals, and that the priesthood of Christ is superior to the Old Testament priesthood. And he uses this final argument now to do that, and he continues to press on as he does this with relentless logic, and he uses Old Testament scriptures to prove his point. Look now at verse 4. Now observe how great this man was to whom Abraham the patriarch gave a tenth of the choicest spoils. This word observe in Greek doesn't mean a casual glance, but it's used of a general who inspects his army. He says, look very carefully, look very distinctly, be very critical now as we look at this new doctrine and watch it very closely. And he says, observe how great this man was who Abraham, and just in case you think I'm speaking of another Abraham, this is Abraham the patriarch. Patri, which means father. Ark, which means first. First father of all of us, he says. And I want you to remember, that's the man I'm speaking of. Don't mix up the people. Notice now how great this man was to whom our first father himself gave a tenth of the choicest spoils. Are you greater than Abraham? They asked. Well, Melchizedek is greater than Abraham. So as he goes on now, he didn't give a tenth of just anything, but he gave a tenth of the choicest spoils. This word in Greek means he gave the tenth that was on the top of the stack. We even use that term today, don't we? It's on the top of the heap. And we point at that as the best of the whole pile, don't we? Well, in Greek warfare, when the Greeks would raid a city, they would take all the loot from the city and put it in a big pile outside, and they always piled the best stuff on the top, and that was dedicated to the gods. So when he said this, that Abraham gave what was on the top of the stack, they knew what he was talking about. That was dedicated to divinity. And he said, that's what Abraham did. When they came back from the slaughter, he gave what was on the top of the stack, the choicest spoils. And this magnified Melchizedek in the minds of the reader, because they understood what he was saying when he said this. Now, in verse 5, we have several things to notice. And those indeed of the sons of Levi who received the priest's office have commandment in the law to collect a tenth from the people, that is, from their brethren, although these are descended, that is, all these other brethren, are descended from Abraham. First of all, not all the sons of Levi became priests. Remember, Levi was the great-grandson of Abraham. He went into Egypt with his father Jacob in 1876 B.C. Moses came out later in 1446 B.C. with his brother Aaron, and from Aaron came the priesthood, Exodus chapter 28, verse 1. So a lot of time went by. There are a lot of descendants of Levi, but Exodus 28, 1 shows that God reached out and took this one descendant from Levi, Aaron, and through Aaron's line, the high priest came. So this is a special group. And he uses this here, and he says that they had a special injunction from God to take tithes from all of the others, even though all of the others were descendants of Abraham. So what's the significance of this? Only that the priests were allowed to take the tithe, the tenth, from all of their brethren by appointment only. Not that they were superior. When they paid their tithes to this descendant of Aaron, they did not necessarily recognize him as being superior. They just recognized that was the law. When you pay money to the IRS agent, when he audits you, you're not necessarily recognizing that he's superior to you as a person, just that he's there representing the law. And that's what he points out here. There was no concept of superiority, inferiority. This is the law, and we pay it. And that's why these descendants of Levi, through Aaron, collected it. That's why their Jewish brethren or Hebrew brethren paid it. It was the law. But with Abraham, he goes on to say, there was no law which said, give a tithe to Melchizedek. The law was not around then. No one commanded Abraham to give tithes to Melchizedek. There was no obligation. He did this voluntarily because in Abraham's mind, he knew immediately when he saw this that Melchizedek was his superior. And he said he voluntarily, not by law, paid tithes to Melchizedek. So, what the author has shown here is that Melchizedek is a superior person to Abraham, and as a result is superior to all of Abraham's descendants. And Abraham acknowledged that. And it could very well be that when he saw the bread and the wine, that was one of the times, or the time, that Christ spoke of when he said, Abram saw my day and was glad. And somehow in Abraham's mind, when he saw this great high priest of God and saw the bread and the wine, something clicked in his mind, and he saw the Messiah who was to come. And the Lord Jesus said, he saw my day and was glad. So he paid tithes. He opened his heart up voluntarily. He said, here, take it. Verse 6, but the one whose genealogy is not traced from them, that is Melchizedek, he was no descendant of Abraham. He collected the tenth from Abraham and blessed the one who had the promises. So when Abraham voluntarily offered the tenth, Melchizedek voluntarily took it. And when he took it, what he did was acknowledge that he was indeed Abram's superior. Now, logic would say, in chapters 12 and 13, we see God giving wonderful promises to Abram. And we would say, well, this is the man who received the promises of God. Surely, he is superior to anyone on the earth. Well, he was, except Melchizedek. Because Melchizedek is there for a very special person. He's the priest of God Most High. And when Abraham meets him, he's going to give him these things. And now, notice what happens. Verse 6, he blessed the one who had the promises. This is the key, he says. Because, he goes on to say, well, with the superior, blessing flows downward, and giving up voluntarily flows upward. That's the concept here. Abram saw Melchizedek as his superior, and he gave upward to his superior. What he had, the best of the spoils. Melchizedek, recognizing his superiority, blessed downward. And the author goes on to say here, verse 7, but without dispute, the lesser is blessed by the greater. So Abraham acknowledged that he was inferior to this marvelous person. Melchizedek acknowledged that he was superior to this person who had been given all the promises of God. And this relationship was established long ago in Genesis chapter 14. Now, had Melchizedek not acknowledged he was superior, what would he have said? He would probably have said what the angel said to John in Revelation 22:9. After John in Revelation 22:8 bowed down before the angel in Revelation 22:9 said, don't do that. I'm a fellow servant just as you are. And if Melchizedek had not recognized his superiority, when Abram began to offer him tithes, he would have said, hold it. I don't want to take that. I'm not worthy of that. But he didn't. He accepted the tithe. And he blessed him. And the author of Hebrews says that relationship was established way back there that now lets us see that there is somehow the origin of a superior priesthood to that which is currently going on right now. Because without dispute, there's no argument. Everything is finished. The lesser is always blessed by the greater. Now he gives a little contrast in verse 8. And in this case, that's present tense. What he means here, look around right now, he says, and you'll see the priesthood going on. The priests right now that are receiving tithes, he says, in the first century A.D., in this case, these men who are dying are receiving tithes. But their office has been done away with. But, he says, verse 8, in that case, what case? In that case back there in the Old Testament, in that case back in Abram's time, we can see that one receives them of who it is witnessed he lives on. So just look around you today, he says, and you'll see dying men receiving tithes. But that system is obsolete. Look back to Genesis 14, and you'll see a man receiving tithes from Abraham, and there's no record of his death. It's almost as if he's living on today, still receiving tithes. And that's the purpose of the genealogical record as it is around him. Verse 9. And, so to speak, through Abraham, now this term, so to speak, is an idiom that was used, a literary idiom, in that time period to introduce something that's a radical departure from what people were accustomed to hearing. It's as if he was saying, get ready for something really heavy. Now, just stay with me, he's saying. So to speak, I'm going to give you a new idea now that descends from this whole idea of the superiority, inferiority of Melchizedek and Abraham. And so to speak, through Abraham, even Levi, his great-grandson paid tithes. You think, how does that work? Well, the Hebrew mind would have understood this because they put a great deal of emphasis on heredity and on genealogy. And what he's talking about here is fact number one, as we know from our New Testament truth, we were all in Adam. And the sin nature of Adam is passed on seminally from Adam. And we were all in Adam, Romans 5:12, shaking our fists in the face of God. And he doesn't develop that here, as Paul does in Romans. But what he says is that there is a concept that in the human race, Levi was in the loins of his great-grandfather. As Aaron was in the loins of Levi, as every descendant currently you see around you, he says, in the first century A.D., in the temple was in the loins of Abraham. Through Eliezer, through Aaron, through Levi. And because they were all back there at the fountainhead of the Hebrew race in the person of Abraham, all of those people were actually paying tithes to Melchizedek. They paid tithes through their father, their ancestor Abraham. And, so to speak, through Abraham, even Levi, who receives tithes, paid tithes, for he was still in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him. So all of the descendants who came down from Abraham through his great-grandson Levi, through Aaron, all down to the priesthood, all of these people, by definition, because they were in the loins of Abraham, are all inferior to Melchizedek. And that's his point. That this priesthood we see today, he says, is an inferior priesthood because there is a greater priesthood that descended from Melchizedek because Melchizedek is superior. So even Aaron, the first high priest, actually paid tithes to someone who is superior, and this affirms the superior order of this perpetual priesthood in Melchizedek, Psalm 110:4, thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So having proven that part, he moves on now, and in this major section between verse 11 and verse 22, he shows that Messiah is the high priest of a testament that actually put away sin instead of just covering sin. Now in verse 11, this is in summary that the Old Testament made nothing complete. Let's see what it says. Now if perfection
was through the Levitical priesthood. That is, this priesthood established in Exodus 28:1 with Aaron and down through his descendants that was currently going on in the first century A.D. He said if that was a system through which perfection would come, for on the basis of it the people received the law, what further need was there for another priest to arise according to the order of Melchizedek and not be designated according to the order of Aaron? The word perfect here in verse 11 means brought to consummation, the completion of the original purpose. Now, what's the original purpose of any priesthood? Whatever priesthood, it's to draw men close to God and to remove the obstacle of sin which separates men from God. That's the purpose of the priesthood. And he said if that old Levitical priesthood could have removed the obstacle of sin and could have brought people close to God, then what's the use of doing away with it? So by the mere fact that God did away with it must indicate that it was an inferior system. Look at chapter 10, verse 4, and we'll see a little hint about that. For it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. That's simple. So because of that, it had to be done away with. It was a system that was typical of what was to come, but it was incomplete. It was imperfect. It did point to Messiah who would come and die on the cross, but it was only an index finger pointing down through history to the one sacrifice who was to come. Look at chapter 10, verse 1a. For the law, that is this whole system, since it has only a shadow of the good things to come, and not the very form of things. So he said the system is a shadow, it's pointing, it's a symbol, it's a type pointing down through time, but it couldn't be a complete system because it could never take away sin. It could never remove the obstacle of sin. So since the priesthood of Aaron was typical, it must be replaced, as he says here, going down to this verse in verse 11. He said there must arise another priest. In the Greek, there are two words for another. One word for another means another of the same kind. If I like this watch so much and eventually it just absolutely wears out, I might go down to my jeweler and I'd say, I want another watch. And you say, you mean another one just like that one? Yeah, I love this watch. I want another one just like that one. But if I don't like this watch, I'm going to go down to my jeweler, and I'm going to say, I want another watch. He's going to say, you need another one like, no, I want another one of a different kind. That's what I want. So I would use this other Greek word, and that's the word here. It means another of another kind, and it's the Greek word heteros, a word which is used quite a bit in the paper today. And heteros means another kind, the same general kind, but another kind. So he said this old priesthood from Aaron, that thing wasn't doing the job, and it's necessary for God to develop another priesthood, another kind. According to the order of Melchizedek, that's the other kind, it's a different kind, not according to the order of Aaron. Now he goes on, and in verse 12, for when the priesthood is changed, of necessity there takes place a change of law also, for the one concerning whom these things are spoken belongs to another tribe, from which no one is officiated at the altar. For it is evident that our Lord was descended from Judah, a tribe with reference to which Moses spoke nothing concerning priests. He goes on, let's just read a couple more verses. And this is clearer still, for if another priest arises according to the likeness of Melchizedek, who has become such not on the basis of a law of physical requirement, but according to the power of an indestructible life, for it is witnessed of him, quote, thou art a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. For on the one hand, there is a setting aside of a former commandment because of its weakness and uselessness, for the law made nothing perfect. And on the other hand, there is a bringing in of a better hope through which we draw near to God. Verse 12, for when the priesthood is changed, metatithemi, what that means is to transpose and put one thing in place of another. So he says what has taken place is there has been a change, a transposition, taking one thing and putting it in place of another. So the priesthood of Melchizedek was put in place of the priesthood of Aaron. transposed. And he said, since the law required and allowed only priests who descended from Aaron, then when God transposed the priesthood from Aaron to Melchizedek, then he had to change the law also. So the law was set aside in order that the descendant of Melchizedek might be a priest, and this Aaronic system was set aside. And we don't have time to look at it. You might want to make a little marginal note, Galatians 3, 12 and 13, just to look at how the law was taken care of through Christ. Now in verse 16, he says that Christ and this Melchizedekan priesthood has become a priest not on the basis of a law of physical requirement. In other words, he's not a priest because he descended from some son of Aaron or some son of Levi. That's not the reason he's a priest, not by legal requirement. But he is a priest, it says, according to the power of an indestructible life, because of who he is, his own divine person. He was laid in the grave, but he came back to life. He rose again, the power of an indestructible life. The other priests, they all died off. They all had to get replaced, generation after generation. Not this one. He descended from no one. He is from eternity, and he is eternal in his person. But he lived and died, but he rose again. And the power of his indestructible life, the very power of his divine person. So after his resurrection and his being seated at the right hand of the Father, God would say to him, thou art a priest forever, after the order of Melchizedek, our blessed Savior, who died and rose again. Then in 18 through 22, he begins to prove that the Old Testament has been set aside in favor of this new covenant. For the law made nothing perfect, we read that in verse 19, and inasmuch as it was not without an oath, for they indeed became priests without an oath, but he with an oath, through the one who has said to him, the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind, thou art a priest forever. Quote again from Psalm 110. So much the more also Jesus has become the guarantee of a better covenant. So in 18, what he really said is again, that old law that's been set aside with just an index finger pointing down toward the Messiah. In verse 19, he says that this new covenant, this bringing in of a better hope through which we can draw near to God, does what that old covenant, the Old Testament, never could do. Then he says down here in these other verses, 20 and 21, in the Aaronic priesthood, even in the calling of Aaron, Moses' brother, in Exodus 28:1, there was never an oath. God never did swear. He just said, go take Aaron, and we're going to make him a priest, and we're going to make him a priest. But there was never an oath connected with that. But he said, now when it comes to this Melchizedekan priesthood, he did make an oath. The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. Thou art a priest forever. So just the institution, he says, of this Melchizedekan priesthood in the person of Messiah is so much stronger and superior, because while the one was just a command, the new Melchizedekan priesthood in Messiah the Son was instituted with an oath. God swore it that he would be a priest forever. What's the result? Verse 22. Jesus has become the guarantee. That's also the word surety. You know what a surety is? What a surety bond is? What it means to be bonded? When you're bonded with a surety bond, that means if there is any malfeasance or any improper behavior, maybe financially, that those who are responsible for the company or those who own the company will get paid and will receive whatever the promises were. And he said, because of this, Jesus Christ has become, in effect, our surety bond. Because of who Jesus is, and because of where he is, you can be assured that even if you default, you're going to get the promises, because he's our surety bond. He has become our guarantee, our surety of this better covenant. What are those promises? Number one, that sins are put away forever, we're justified, and that we have a hope of spending eternity with him. And Jesus is our surety bond for those things. Sins forgiven, and eternity with the Father. And he's seated at the right hand of God, just as if we take out a bond because of who he is. On verses 23 through 25, he's going to demonstrate that Messiah lives forever while the others died. So much the more also Jesus has become the guarantee or surety of a better covenant. And the former priests, on the one hand, existed in greater numbers. Why? Well, they kept dying. That's why. They had to be replaced. Generation after generation, the old guy would die and hand the baton on. And the old people would stand around and say, oh, I just love that old priest. You know, I shared my heart with him. He was the greatest priest we ever had, but he's dead. And his son's coming along. I don't like his son. Watched him grow up. Never did like him. He could never be a priest to me like his dad was. So always, generation after generation, the old priest would die, and he would come along and have this transition over and over and over again. And all of the undercurrent and the grumblings that go along with any kind of a change of power. And he said, this system isn't like that. These old priests would die, existing in greater numbers, because they were prevented by death from continuing. But he, Christ, on the other hand, because he abides forever, holds his priesthood permanently. He never dies. He abides forever. He never needs to be replaced. Thou art a priest forever, God said, after the order of Melchizedek. Only an empty grave shows where our priest was. The graveyards are full of the descendants of Aaron, but not our high priest. You can't find where he's buried, because he's at the right hand of the Father. And why is that important? Verse 25 tells us. That's the result of this. Hence also he is able to save forever, as the King James says, to the uttermost, those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. And you'll see that it is the word forever. And if you have a marginal note there, 25, it says completely. It's actually more than this. It's the word panteles, which means it's kind of a two-dimensional salvation. Because he's an eternal high priest, he can save the believer, as the margin says, in his complete totality, body, soul, spirit, and all of that he can do to the point of termination, to the point of completeness. And since eternity goes on forever, it'll never end. It'll be complete through all eternity and never stop. So that's the importance of having a high priest who doesn't die, but one who lives forever. And that's what we mean by being confirmed in righteousness. When the Lord returns, when we meet him in the air, he lives forever to make intercession for us, to bring us to perfection and completeness, which never ends. We're saved forever. There'll never be the chance of ever sinning again. So there'll never be another Eden. We're confirmed in righteousness forever, because he ever lives in his role as high priest, that position, confirmed in righteousness forever. Now, I'm not being exclusive. God is being exclusive. What does that verse say? You don't come to God by being a Baptist. And I'm sorry, you don't come to God by being a Presbyterian or a Roman Catholic or a Mormon. How do you come to God? By him. He is the only high priest God has appointed. That's why Christ can say, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me. It's an exclusive system. There's no other way. So if you don't like that, if you don't like what I'm saying, you can't dislike me, dislike the Bible. Because that's what it says. There is no other way.
This concludes Side A. Please turn to Side B. Thank you.